From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Hairspray, the new film and the original one. First, we'll talk with Adam Shankman about directing and choreographing the new movie musical. He had to come up with the dance moves for John Travolta to do in drag and a fat suit. The role was originally played by Divine, a 300-pound man who played the leading lady in many of John Waters' early films. Later, we'll hear our 1988 interview with John Waters about writing and directing the original Hairspray movie. Hairspray, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our show today is all about Hairspray, the original film and the new one.
Hey there, teenage Baltimore! Don't change that channel, because it's time for the Corny Collins Show! Brought to you by Ultra Clutch Hairspray. Though every afternoon when the clock strikes four, a crazy bunch of kids crash through that door, yeah.
Hairspray is set in Baltimore in the early 60s when teenagers rush home after school to watch the Corny Collins dance show, a local show that's like American Bandstand without the big stars. Tracy Turnblad is a fat girl whose dream is to dance on the show, but being fat isn't cool. Later we'll hear a 1988 interview with John Waters about writing and directing the original Hairspray. His film was adapted into the hit Broadway musical that became the basis of the new film. My guest Adam Shankman directed and choreographed the new Hairspray. Before making Hairspray, Shankman choreographed music videos and films including Boogie Nights and Stuck on You. In his new film Hairspray, Tracy is played by newcomer Nikki Blonsky. Her father is played by Christopher Walken. Her mother is played by John Travolta in drag and in a fat suit. In this scene, Tracy has just told her mother she wants to audition to dance on the Corny Collins show. Her mother is ironing as she responds.
No one is auditioning for anything in this household.
But why not? Why not?
Dancing is not your future. One day you're going to own Edna's Occidental Laundry.
I don't want to be a laundress. I want to be famous.
Well, if you want to be famous, learn how to take blood out of car upholstery. That's a skill you can take right to the bank.
Hey, hey. What's all this rubbish in here?
Daddy, tomorrow I'm auditioning to dance on a TV show.
No, she what? Is not. First the hair, now this.
But all the kids are batting up their hair now, hon.
You're no help.
It's ratting, Daddy. And our First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, does it.
I don't believe that.
What do you mean you don't believe that? How else would it look that way?
I believe that it is naturally stiff.
Adam Shankman, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you're good friends with the songwriters who did the songs for Hairspray. And you've said that you've seen the Broadway show about 20 times.
Yeah,
so
I have.
When you set out to make the movie and you already had the show so much in your head, what did you do to kind of get rid of the show and start fresh with the movie? Or maybe not. Maybe you felt like you should do what the show did.
Well, no. I it was really interesting. When I got the job, this is going to sound so sad and lame, but I got John Waters' email address because that's where I needed to start, because all roads of Hairspray lead back to John Waters. So I got his email address, and I think I basically typed him, "Dear Mr. Waters, my name is Adam Shankman. You don't know me, but I've been hired to direct and choreograph the new adaptation of Hairspray. I hope you don't mind." And he emailed me back, like, "Let's have lunch tomorrow," because I was in Baltimore producing a movie there when I got the job. And we had lunch the next day, and he said de facto, "Don't do what I did. Don't do what the play did. You got to do your own thing." And I really took that very seriously, and I thought, okay, great. This is now being given, like, permission by God to go out and do my thing, you know, at least the God of Hairspray.
Since Hairspray is a period piece set in the 60s about a TV dance show, the choreography had to be tied, at least the choreography that the teenagers do in the context of the dance show, had to be very 60s. So what are some of the things that you watched to get inspiration for the choreography?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I've choreographed a lot of material that sort of was from this period, and I happen to love it. And there's a lot of different things that I drew inspiration from. You know, I'm a huge fan, you're going to laugh, of like the whole Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello movies.
The beach movies?
The beach movies. And I've watched a lot of Elvis. But, you know, even going back to Bye Bye Birdie and, you know, the theatricalized versions of things from this era. You know, I've watched a lot of old American Bandstand. And then I watched crazy, like, Hullabaloo, which was all Michael Bennett choreography, so it was really odd and kind of fabulous and brilliant. But where I started out as a visual base was there was a great documentary called Shake, Rattle, and Roll Which was a documentary about the Buddy Dean Show, which is the show that the Corny Collins Show in Hairspray is based upon. And it was the show that John Waters used to watch growing up, and the kids that he knew in high school that this whole thing is based on. The whole, you know, Hairspray started with an essay or an article, I'm sorry, that John wrote called The Nicest Kids in Town. And then it was published, and then he kind of blew it up, and it became Hairspray. And it was all about the kids on this show. So I watched that show, and it's really, the dancing is really dull, but it's the little dances of the era, and they're mostly like little repetitive steps, like the mashed potato or the pony or, you know, twisting and stuff like that. And so I basically sat there and keyed all of my choreography using that as a base and then blowing it up to musical size.
One of the things in the story Hairspray is that, you know, the Corny Collins dance show is a very white show, but once a week, it's Negro Day.
Once a month,
once
yeah.
a month, I'm sorry, it's Negro Day. And all, like, the black kids who are dancers get to be on the show, and there's a black host instead of Corny Collins. She's played by Queen Latifah in the movie. And so what are some of the differences between, like, the white choreography that you did and the black choreography that you did?
Well, one of my associate choreographers, Jamal Sims, who is African-American, and his family had danced on a show like the Corny Collins Show. And so, like, I think his mother and father, his aunts and uncles. And he went over to their house and he filmed them doing the dances that they were doing, one called the Hully Gully, the Fly, the Slop. And those had a lot of more soul. They had a lot more hip action. They were looser. The white kids' dancing was very uptight. It was very tight in the core of your body. It was very centered. Whereas a lot of the African-American style stuff was very loose. And I love that because it was all of the same era, but it was, you know, it in and of itself was actually different. And so he filmed them doing that. And there's a number in the movie called Run and Tell That, which is literally taking a bunch of those steps and linking them all together and then just kind of pushing the size of the steps a little bit bigger. But it's all authentic steps, really, from the era.
Did you ever want to be on a teen dance show when you were growing up?
Oh, my God. I wanted to do it all, and my parents wouldn't let me. It made me so upset. They kept saying, you need a solid education. I was like, you just let me be on a commercial, just for Lucky Charms, anything. Just please. I would have killed. I would have killed. My dad was producing TV a bit back then, and there was a kid on the Brady Bunch named Robbie Rist who played Oliver, Cousin Oliver. And I knew Robbie and this girl, Kim Richards, who was on Escape from Witch Mountain. There were these child actors that I knew that were kind of in my life. And all I wanted to do was be them. And my parents wouldn't let me. So it really bummed me out. But I didn't actually start dancing until I was 18.
That's really
old. Yeah. How sad is that? That's really old. To be 18 to start dancing, but it really is, in fact, if you're really training. But I was
well, particularly because you can do splits and all of that. I mean,
I can still do that, but that's like a cheap parlor trick for me. I was a competitive gymnast when I was a kid,
Oh. So
my body has certain kind of facilities that
Oh. You
know allow me to still have that kind of flexibility, which is weird, I think, even to me. But it's just the way my body's built.
So what were you dancing when you were in high school?
When I was 17, I graduated high school, and I moved to Minneapolis and I joined a repertory theater company called the Children's Theater Company in school. And they do in repertory a lot of original shows, and most of them are musicals. And so I found myself in the company dancing a lot and suddenly getting lead roles as the dancer in them, but I still hadn't taken any classes. I just sort of had this natural ability. And then I decided that dancing was kind of mostly what I should be doing. And I auditioned for all of the big schools, NYU and Juilliard and North Carolina, and I actually got into all of them in the dance programs, including Juilliard. I got into having never taken a dance class in my life, which was crazy. It was like flash dance.
Oh.
It was ridiculous. Yeah.
Let me get back to Hairspray for a second.
Yeah.
Now, in Hairspray, I know that John Travolta was cast before you were actually hired to direct and choreograph the film. Now, mm-hmm. In the original movie, the John Waters movie, the mother, you know, the very heavy mother, Edna Turnblad, is played by Divine. Now, Divine was a nearly 300-pound man who was always the leading lady while he was alive in John Waters movies. And in the stage version, the mother was played by Harvey Fierstein, who is not quite as overweight as Divine by any means, but, you know, he can put on the weight. And he's very gay and very out. And whereas Travolta is a kind of, you know, fairly trim man who's straight. How do you feel about casting like a straight, you know, reasonably trim man in the part?
Well,
and because Travolta has to wear a lot of like prosthetics.
There's a few reasons. Yeah. There's a few reasons for all that. In the tradition of Hairspray, which started with John, obviously casting Divine, it's one of my favorite things that Edna is played by a man because it's anarchistic. It's basically a lot of the point of it. It's the don't judge a book by its cover, you know, credo in the Hairspray kind of legacy. And I love that part of it because it's just, it's such a nose thumb to the world. And when they told me about that they were talking to John, I strangely immediately understood, because knowing that they were wanting to make a big commercial hit movie out of this and it's a musical, what man are you going to go to that's the biggest musical star that we have? And because of Grease and Saturday Night Fever, it is John Travolta. Grease is the highest grossing musical of all time at this point. And so I thought, oh, God, that makes sense. And the thing that I loved about it was that I could now get Edna dancing. Because we haven't seen John Travolta dance really dance since, well, Stayin' Alive, actually, but it's the sequel to Saturday Night Fever.
You don't need to go there.
Yeah, but, you know, but he was dancing, and I thought this is fantastic. And then I started thinking about Fantasia, the cartoon of Fantasia and those dancing hippos, and I was like, this is awesome, because what it could be is like Edna, you know, dances as if she's weightless, and I thought that was sort of thrilling, just the possibilities of it. So I never went to sort of a dark place. I mean, the interesting thing is that I think why people have a bit of a problem with it, if there is a problem with it, is because both Harvey and Divine, I think, were generally thought of in their way as like character actors. Even though they played leads in what they did, they're still not traditional leading men. John is a very traditional leading man and has been so for a long time. Very on the testosterone-fueled part, but that also makes it more fun. Once again, it plays with the anarchy of the piece.
Well, there's a great soft shoe in the movie between Travolta and Christopher Walken, who plays Edna's husband. And I love watching both Travolta dance and Christopher Walken dance. I love watching Christopher Walken move.
Did you ever see Pennies from Heaven?
I love the scene in that.
God, he's so amazing. That's why I really wanted Chris so much, because besides the fact that he in himself is like a novelty shop to a certain extent, he's just such an unusual and individual, brilliant and interesting actor who makes what seem like crazy choices, and they all fall together in the most brilliant way. To have that kind of randomness out there dancing, the two of them, I mean, sometimes I'd have to step away and go, what the hell am I shooting?
Can you talk a little bit about what you put together for the two of them?
There's a number in Hairspray called Timeless to Me, which is a reaffirmation of Edna and Wilbur's love. And I love this so much because it's actually one of the only old-fashioned moments in Hairspray. And it's a love story, really, between the two characters. And I got to really play with it. And there's all sorts of great lyrics about, you know, that turn on each other, like, you're like a stinky old cheese, dear, just getting riper with age, you know. You're like a fatal disease, babe. And if there's no cure, just let this fever rage. They're so connected in their eyes and in the way that they behave with each other. And it's so genuine and loving. And so then when they erupt into the dance, it's heaven.
Well, why don't we hear the song that Travolta and Christopher Walken sing in the movie version of Hairspray.
Styles keep a-changing, the world's rearranging, but Edna, you're timeless to me. Hemlines are shorter, a beer costs a quarter, but time cannot take what comes free. You're like a stinky old cheese, babe, just getting riper with age. You're like a fatal disease, babe, but there's no cure, so let this fever rage. Some folks can't stand it, say time is a bandit, but I take the opposite view. 'Cause when I need a lift, time brings a gift, another day with you. A twist or a waltz, it's all the same schmaltz, with just a change in the scenery. You'll never be old hat, that's that. You're timeless to me.
Oh, Wilbur, all of you.
Feds keep a-fading, Castro's invading, but Wilbur, you're timeless to me. Hairdos are higher, mine feels like barbed wire, but you say I'm chic as can be. You're like a rare vintage ripple, a vintage they'll never forget. So pour me a teeny weeny triple, and we can toast the fact we ain't dead yet. I can't stop eating.
That's John Travolta and Christopher Walken from the soundtrack of the new movie Hairspray. We'll talk more with Adam Shankman, the director and choreographer of the film, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Adam Shankman, and he choreographed and directed the new film adaptation of Hairspray. What were the pop dances when you were coming of age?
When I was coming of age? Oh, God. I think when I was coming of age, it was right when breakdancing was starting. You know, the electric boogaloo and all of that. And there was a movie called Breaking Electric Boogaloo, which I loved. And there was a great movie called Fast Forward about, you know, the very beginnings of, like, pop locking and all of that. That was all really popular when I was a kid.
So did you break dance?
Oh, God, no. Are you kidding? I would have looked. I'm like a skinny Jew. Like, that would have looked horrible.
But you were a gymnast, so you could have done some of that.
I'm so more like a little gymnast. I was so not tough. And, you know, those kids were so, like, tough and street. And I was so, like, fake preppy Jew.
So no electric boogaloo or anything?
No, there wasn't, although I tried, you know. I sort of looked better doing the steps that the girls were doing, like fan kicks and all of that.
But wait a minute, weren't you in Paula Abdul and Janet Jackson videos?
Yeah, I did. I did dance for them. I had gotten out of Juilliard. I dropped out, and I went. And I was doing a lot of theater dancing because that's really what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a chorus boy. And so I was doing a lot of that. Ended up having kind of a bad relationship experience, frankly, my first one. I was 21 or whatever. And moved back to Los Angeles. I'd been living in New York. And I thought I was going to stop dancing. And I wanted to produce music videos. That was my big goal. And I had a friend who was producing a Janet Jackson video. And she convinced me to audition. And I got in. And then I did some work for her. And I did the Oscars for Paula Abdul and stuff like that. But that was something that, you know, like I said, I was already dancing professionally at that point. So that was just a job, you know.
Describe for us what you had to do in the Janet Jackson video.
Oh, tumble. I was doing so much gymnastics. My whole body was, like, racked with pain. I was like, what? We were on the Universal back lot. And I, on Mexico Street, and I was tumbling down that stupid street for about 7.5 straight hours into the morning. And when I tell you, I woke up and I could not move because it was cement And I was like barefoot. it was the most brutal thing on the planet. But and I was just a little gymnast boy at that point.
What was the song?
Escapade. And then I went out and I danced, and I also tumbled and danced on the American Music Awards for her. Same song.
And for the Oscars?
For the Oscars, we were doing Paula Abdul. We were doing Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid. And I was like a lycra-clad flipping pirate and did the crab dance and all of that. So it was really funny.
You ended up choreographing a lot of videos. Like, what are some of the acts you choreographed for?
A pretty popular Whitney Houston video called I'm Your Baby Tonight. I did Tony, Tony, Tony Feels Good. I did a song called The Jerk Out for the Time. I even sort of choreographed something, one of Herb Ritz's last videos. I worked with NSYNC doing some Charlie Chaplin stuff for the video Gone. I did like giant rock videos where girls were like on the top of giant scaffolding, throwing themselves around. I mean, it was crazy. Back in like the real heyday of like that kind of stuff. I worked a lot with Julian Temple, who was the director of Absolute Beginners. And he did the very famous Janet Jackson When I Think of You video where she goes through the town. And that was basically based on his opening shot of Absolute Beginners.
Adam Shankman choreographed and directed the new movie Hairspray. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey, old friend, let's look back on the crazy clothes we wore. Ain't it fun to look back and to see it's all been done before? All those nights together have special memories.
And I can't wait for tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Stuart, A Life Backwards, about the unlikely friendship between a homeless man and the author, Alexander Masters. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, gatesfoundation.org. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Waters talks about writing and directing his 1988 movie Hairspray, and we continue our conversation with Adam Shankman about making the new movie musical adaptation.
You're looking good, a big strong line. When I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back with a big strong turn and back to the medicine. Hit top. You're looking good. Now when I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back, double cross, come out of it with the rifleman. Hit top. Crazy. Now when I say hit it, I want the big strong M, erase it and back to the mast.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Adam Shankman, the choreographer and director of the new movie Hairspray. Before directing movies, he choreographed music videos and films, including Boogie Nights and Stuck on You. He got his start dancing with Janet Jackson and Paula Abdul. Hairspray stars Nikki Blonsky and several other newcomers, along with James Marsden, Michelle Pfeiffer, Queen Latifah, Christopher Walken, and John Travolta. Now, John Travolta is one of the stars of Hairspray. What impact did Saturday Night Fever have on you? You were, what, around 12 when it came out?
Yeah, I was young when Saturday Night Fever came out, but it was literally one of my father's favorite movies, and still is. And we saw it in the theaters a couple times, and I thought it was completely magical because not only was I entranced by the music and the dancing and how the music was used and how it was all pop music being used as a musical form that included the dancing, but then to have the dramatic content of it was mind-blowing to me, even at that age, you know. But, of course, I was like the 10-year-old that was sneaking into theaters to see all that jazz when I was 10. So, you know, I was a bit of an anomaly, but I was very impacted by Saturday Night Fever.
Now, one of the movies that you choreographed was Boogie Nights, which is such a great film. And there's a couple of, you know, like disco party scenes in that. And in one of the scenes, one of the earlier scenes, the dancing is kind of clumsy. Everybody's a little self-conscious, and they're not like particularly good dancers. But in the later scene, like after the main character, you know, Dirk Diggler, the Mark Wahlberg character, after he's gotten more self-confident, he's doing a real Travolta thing.
it's definitely a tip of the hat to Saturday Night Fever. In fact, I was friends with Lester Wilson, rest his soul, who choreographed Saturday Night Fever.
Oh.
He was a great man. And he had told me a story once that, I don't know if it's true, but he told me the story that the original step in Saturday Night Fever was not just the one hand going up, but it was two hands going up and then pointing down and two and up. And that Travolta somehow ended up being more comfortable with the single hand. So after Lester died and I was doing Boogie Nights, I said, you know what, I'm going to give Lester his original step back. And I did the two fingers up and down thing.
Oh, God, that's so great.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's it like when you're choreographing? There's that scene. And then before that, there's a scene where people are just kind of very amateurishly dancing. Did you choreograph that or did you just say to everybody?
What you do is you give them a sort of a step vocabulary. You show them a bunch of steps and then you don't polish them. And you kind of send them out on their own and you make sure that that it's properly staged and you work with the director to, you know, get the shape down with the camera, and then, you know, you just hope that the actors understand who their characters are and what they're supposed to be doing, how they are.
What were some of the movie musicals or Broadway musicals that helped create, like, your fantasy life or your...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to sound really, really odd, but the first musical that I saw live was Promises, Promises, and Michael Bennett did that, and it was...
That's a Burt Bacharach musical.
It's a Bacharach musical that was based on the Neil Simon play, The Apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Orbach and Jill O'Hara were in it. And it's just, it was just fabulous to me. I could not believe how amazing it was. And I really grew up on Sound of Music and West Side Story, My Fair Lady, the classics.
Speaking of West Side Story, I thought the opening shot of your movie Hairspray was a shout out to the opening shot of West Side Story because it's this aerial view over the city.
Yeah, well, but it came through the clouds, so I comboed it with Sound of Music. It was Sound of Music into West Side Story. I have a lot of those in Hairspray. When she's on the garbage truck, that's like the tugboat from Funny Girl. And when I had her hair also like in Funny Girl at the end of Welcome to the 60s and... You know, there's a lot of shout-outs at the musical. Somebody was talking about in Without Love when he's singing into the picture. It's like, dear Mr. It's like You Made Me Love You when Judy Garland is singing to Clark Gable. And, you know, there's a lot of winks in this one.
Now, I could see, like, when you're growing up, if you're particularly, you know, in previous decades, like when you're growing up, that adults or teachers might say to you, well, being gay is going to hold you back from accomplishing this certain thing in life. But when your goal is to do, like, musicals, like, no one can really say, you're gay, you'll never get your crack at doing musicals. Do you know what I'm saying?
True words have never been spoken, but I had a very, very reverse experience of coming out, which was that my parents actually outed me to me. I was dating girls, and they were divorced at the time, and right before I left to move to Minneapolis to join the theater company, they both individually kind of pulled me aside and said, you know, by the way, you're gay and we love you. And I was like, what are you talking about? This isn't happening to me. What are you saying? You know, I guess it was kind of because I wasn't doing anything with anybody. So it was just something they felt about me. And I think that as sweet as they were, they wanted me to be happy. And that was of utmost importance to them. And I don't know. Listen, when I was 3 years old, I had like a sexual identity crisis. And my parents put me with a doctor who I guess tried to kind of reprogram me, and they felt like that was a big mistake. So, because it kind of messed with my head and my self-esteem. So that was, I think, their loving way of saying it's all good.
Your mother's a therapist, right?
Yeah. And a good one, actually.
What kind of sexual identity crisis did you have at the age of 3?
You know, I was 3 years old and I was running around doing, you know, singing The Sound of Music, wearing my dad's t-shirts and belting them. And, you know, so they had a waist, you know. And you know, when I was, instead of playing Tony, I was playing Maria. Or actually, I was playing Anita in West Side Story because she had the sexier songs. But I was 3, you know, and... It's as sad as it sounds, it's true. But it genuinely was a phase. But, you know, I think for my parents in 1967, and they were really young when they had me, I think it was just nerve-wracking. So they put me with a therapist in a program at UCLA who was just supposed to kind of observe me. But what they didn't know is that he was actually trying to reprogram me.
You know, in your career as a choreographer, you've not only choreographed dances, but you've choreographed like non-dance movies, where the choreography, I guess, is more about physical comedy.
Yeah, yeah, like George of the Jungle. Are you talking about?
Oh, I'm thinking specifically of Stuck on You, which is
Stuck on You. There's a huge dance number at the end with Meryl Streep.
Oh, that's true.
I was actually in it.
I
play the like waiter on her left. I was like, I'm not going to miss this opportunity. I'm dancing with Meryl Streep, damn it.
Okay.
I did that final number. But like in George of the Jungle, there were a couple little dance scenes, but I was on George of the Jungle for like 5 months. I started dealing with wire work with Brendan Fraser and then doing rock climbing and trampoline work, gymnastic stuff. And then when the movie started, he decided that he wanted me there all the time, literally just to watch the physicality of his performance. Because I did a lot of those movies that were cartoons to... movies like I did Flintstones and Casper and George the Jungle, and you know, it's like all sort of maintaining the integrity of the movement vocabulary of the cartoon while giving it life. It's a very funky business, but I did a lot of it.
You know, you were telling us earlier about the video that you had to do, which required you tumbling for about 7 hours on concrete.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any injuries that give you like recurring pain from all the dancing that you've done over the years?
Yeah, I have really bad pain in my left hip, like lower back stuff. It's totally chronic. And then, unbelievably, the month before I started to choreograph Hairspray, I was actually hanging out with some friends and dancing around, and I slipped on a spilled cocktail and I tore every part of my knee.
Oh.
After all those years of dancing, LCL, MCL, ACL, and my MCL and LCL healed, but I still don't have an ACL, and I choreographed all of Hairspray with one very injured knee.
Wow. You know, dancers amaze me because, like, on the one hand, when you're a dancer, you seem to, like, defy gravity and do all these things that normal bodies were never meant to do. And at the same time, I know dancers, like what you were just saying, end up with injuries and are walking around in pain. Do you ever get angry with your body for hurting, you know, for being vulnerable?
Yeah, I get really angry with my body for hurting because, you know, no one warns you about these things. And I also wonder, could I have made it any different by stretching more or by not doing that stupid stunt? I remember when I was doing the Academy Awards, they were making me throw, stupidly, this giant back layout flip that landed in the front splits, and I broke 5 of my toes. I broke 3 of my toes doing it, and it was like the first week of rehearsal. And so I went on with my toes taped and went on to do 4 more weeks of rehearsal and dance the entire show. And, of course, never even performed the trick. But, by the way, I would have performed it anyway because it's just what you do. Dancers are the most the show must go on people out there. They're the least paid and the hardest workers, for sure.
Well, Adam Shankman, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was an extraordinary pleasure to be here.
Adam Shankman choreographed and directed the new movie Hairspray. Coming up, a 1988 interview with John Waters about writing and directing the original movie Hairspray. This is Fresh Air. the new movie Hairspray, and the hit Broadway musical that it's adapted from owe it all to John Waters, one of the eccentric icons of the independent film world. He wrote and directed the original 1988 movie Hairspray. It's set in 1962, at the height of the teen dance show craze. The story revolves around a fat girl named Tracy Turnblad, whose dream is to dance on the local TV dance show. In the new movie musical version of Hairspray, Tracy's mother, Edna, is played by John Travolta in drag and a fat suit. In the original film, the mother was played by Divine, a 300-pound man who was often the leading lady in Waters movies. In this scene from the original Hairspray, Divine, as Edna, is taking her daughter to Mr. Pinky's hefty hideaway house for ample women to pick out some new clothes for the dance show.
Mr. Pinky, I'm Tracy's business manager, Edna Turnblad.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet the both of you. Here we cater to the big bone gals like yourself who are stylish and at the same time frustrated by the lack of sizes in the department stores today. I saw you on TV. I want you to be my model.
Would she be paid for this?
One free outfit a month. You start tomorrow. I hope there's no diets in the works because I want to design your Miss Otto Show coronation gown myself.
Could you throw in a pair of complimentary petty pants in the deal?
You drive a hard bargain, Miss Edna, and rightfully so. Petty pants, panty girdle, you just let Tracy take her pick.
It's a deal. Thank you, Mr. Pinky.
I'm going to make you a star.
I spoke with John Waters in 1988 when his film Hairspray was released. I asked him if the Corny Collins show, the dance show in the film, was based on the Baltimore dance show he grew up watching, the Buddy Dean show.
I watched all the teen dance shows, and so it's all of them sort of put together and pushed one step a little further. But it's not that exaggerated, basically. The kids really did look like that then. The hairdos, all that, was part of it. It wasn't a rebel look. Your mother had that hairdo, too.
I think a lot of us learned what it would be like to be a teenager by watching the dance shows. Did you watch the dance shows all
that? Sure, you learned how to be a teenager from it. I mean, and there were so many gimmick dances that you had to, they only lasted about a week in popularity. There were so many of them. So you had to watch these shows. It was like homework for the weekend because everybody do those dances. And if you didn't know how to do them that weekend, you didn't have time because there was already a new one out.
You have every record and more that I can remember, the novelty records. You have the Continental, the Fly.
The Bug.
The Roach.
The Shake a Tail Feather, the Madison. And they're all real dances.
Well, I figured, first of all, why did you include so many of the novelty dances in the movie?
Well, because I love them, and I wanted to bring them back. I wanted the fact that was sort of a forgotten period when every dance was a gimmick dance. So I had all those records. They were my favorite records. I used to get them out late at night and after a few drinks and put them on.
And dance.
Sometimes even dance. So I picked those songs first and sort of wrote the movie around them, that I wanted to include them.
Everybody in your movies, as you say, is usually really, they're outcasts, and they're frequently somewhere between odd and bizarre looking.
Yeah.
What was your look when you were a teenager?
I went through different looks. At one period, I was preppy because that's how I grew up. But then I had bleached hair in the front, and I used to wear, then I wanted to be a beatnik. It was hard to be a beatnik in suburban Baltimore. But I wanted to be one, and I read all the books about them and everything, and read Life magazine about beatniks, and I just really wanted to be one. That's why I have the whole scene with the whole beatnik scene in the movie.
Well, there's a great scene where Tracy and her boyfriend go into, they're looking for a place to hide out, basically.
Right.
They knock on a door. Everybody's turning them away, but these two beatniks in the door that they knock on let them in, and the beatniks are Rick Ocasek and Pia Zadora.
Right.
And it's this great beatnik scene in their pad. The scene is a wonderful confrontation between the bouffant hairdo ethic and the beatnik long black straight hair ethic.
The ironed hair. Which is not an exaggeration. Around 62 in Baltimore, all the girls had those big hairdos. And then suddenly, a few of the really hip ones started doing their hair straight, and people panicked. And it was called going Joe, meaning Joe College. And people would say, I don't know, should I be Joe? I can't decide. I don't know what to do. It was a major thing. And what happened then is the kids that did do the ironed hair eventually became hippies. And the ones with the teased hair got married and became probably very middle class.
You look like a hair hopper to me. I mean, your hair is really uncool.
How do you get your hair so straight and so flat?
With an iron, man. I play my bongos, listen to Odetta, and then I iron my hair, dig?
I think we better get going now. The coast looks clear.
Let's do some reefer. We'll get high and I'll iron the chick's hair.
Reefer?
Drugs? Loco weed. When I'm high, I am Odetta.
In the movie, you call women with really large hairdos hair hoppers.
Yeah.
Is that a Baltimore
expression?
That's
a Baltimore expression.
Yeah, I never, it's a great expression.
Yeah.
I never
Men can be hair hoppers, too. A male hair hopper is, you know, greased back and the continental look, it was called, with sport coats with a belt in the back and pointy toe shoes and that look. A hair hopper basically is someone that grew up without a lot of money, suddenly gets some, spends it wrongly, thinks they have style and don't.
Did you use real hairspray in the movie? In the opening scene, everybody's like spraying their
hair. It's real
hairspray.
Yeah. We used roughly 60 cases of hairspray in the movie. And because there's 1,100 extras. And when you worked on this movie, you had to go, it was like going into the fashion army. The boys had to go on one trailer, get their hair cut, then go to the next thing and get their hair slicked back. The girls had to go in, get it teased. We had like Chris Mason, who did all the hairdo, but then we had backups, people that would tease it. Then she'd come in and style it. You had to go through an assembly line. So a lot of the kids that were in it finally got so sick of combing it out that they would just leave it in and they would just go out in Baltimore with those ridiculous hairdos and just figure, too bad. You know, I can't go through this hairdo torture another day. Let's just leave it in.
Your movie set in 1962.
Yeah.
This is currently a period when there's actually a lot of nostalgia for 1962?
No, there's a lot of nostalgia for the 60s, but 62 is almost the 50s. There were no hippies. There were no drugs. Kennedy hadn't even been shot. It was right before everything changed.
That's why you chose that year?
Yeah. And so when people talk about the 60s, they talk about girls dancing in cages with fringe and or hippies or the student rebellion or all that. This was way before any of that.
One of the big storylines in Hairspray is about the integration of this dance show.
Right.
And because it's a white-only show, except they have Negro Day once a month.
Which they did. That's not an exaggeration.
In the show you watched
in
Baltimore?
Yes. And they had them on other shows, too. And basically, I felt that to ignore that fact would have been really inauthentic. I don't know, is that the correct word? But if Hollywood had made this movie, they would have had blacks on the show and just ignored the fact that none of the shows, Bandstands didn't have blacks on it either. None of them did then. And basically the problem was that all the music was black, all the dancing came from blacks, black singers were on the show all the time as entertainers, but they couldn't dance. And it wasn't because the kids didn't want it, their parents didn't want it.
One of the things I really loved in the movie is that the worst insult that one girl can say about another is, she's a whore.
Well, they used to, didn't they? When I went to high school, they always used to say this, that girl's a whore.
Except it was, that girl's a hua.
Yeah, right. And, you know, the girls that they said that about never were.
Oh, of course. I mean, how many girls in my high school were really whores?
I know. I mean, they were charging money. There weren't too many of that. But they never even slept with anybody. But if you got the reputation as a whore, it lasted. And they always used to say that, whisper, oh, that girl, she's a whore. You know, it was always, at least when I went to junior high, that was a very big insult.
Did you always want to know, like, what the real story was behind that?
I always hung around with the ones that they thought were the whores, actually.
We're listening back to a 1988 interview with John Waters about writing and directing the original movie Hairspray. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with John Waters about writing and directing the original film, Hairspray. He told me he thought of Hairspray as a satire of two dreaded genres, the teen flick and the message movie. I asked him about pitching the movie to producers.
They had a couple movies I wanted to do, and I knew that this one, was one obsession I had that was possibly palatable to movie executives. So I thought I'd better go with this one.
How did you pitch it to movie executives?
I got up and did the dances in front of them for
oh,
one thing.
That's
and
great.
They were so startled that they realized I was serious about it. I played them the music. I got a development deal for it. It was done very conventionally.
Oh, that's not conventional, going and doing the dances.
You've ever been to a pitch
check?
Session?
Really?
I don't know. You got to sell the movie. You got about 10 minutes.
Do you have a less saleable version in your mind? Like a really
no.
more...
Uh-huh. I didn't calculate this to be, oh, this is going to be more commercial and everything. I thought the subject matter had a chance to be, certainly, but it wasn't certainly. I didn't make a movie I didn't want to make. I didn't cut anything out to go wider or anything like that. It just came out this way. And it was an obsession. I mean, I thought it would be inappropriate to have sex and gore in this because that wasn't part of this whole memory. I think it's still a John Waters movie. But it's PG, which I think is great. I wish it was G because that's the only way left that people are surprised. And all my films have been based on surprise.
There are some regulars, people who've worked with you in many of your movies, who are featured in your new movie. Divine is
right.
in it. Ming Stoll is in it. But there are some new people who've never been in your movies
yeah.
before, like Tracy,
well,
the
well,
lead.
Well, we have Tracy, who's Ricky Lake. Well, certainly Debbie Harry, who I'd worked with a little bit. She wrote part of the music for Polyester. Jerry Stiller, who plays Divine's husband. Sonny Bono, who plays sort of the villain in it.
Why were you so anxious to cast Sonny Bono?
Oh, I always just like Sonny Bono. I mean, no, you never say, no casting agent says, get me a Sonny Bono type. There's only one Sonny Bono. And that's what I like, is actors that they're unique. And everybody knows who Sonny Bono is.
I had some new campaign flyers made up today. All for Daddy's little girl. Now, I want you to hand those out at the hop tonight to everyone, each and every one of those.
Oh, Daddy! No lip from you, Miss Ingrate. This campaign is costing us an arm and a leg.
New gowns? Hairdresser three times a week? Why, your hairspray bill alone is enough to eat up all the profits from the Tilt-A-Whirl.
You'll do as Daddy says, or we'll send you to Catholic school where you belong. Right, Franklin?
That's right.
I bet a lot of real odd characters send you resumes all the time, figuring, like, well, I'm kind of freaky. Waters would really love me.
Yeah, but they're real
movie.
Wrong, because the people that are freaky in real life generally make terrible actors. Good actors, actually, in real life, are shy and very quiet people a lot of the time.
Gee, why do you think that's true?
I don't know. They come alive with a camera. Where people that are always on in real life, as soon as the camera comes on, tend to be very stilted sometimes.
Huh. You cast Divine in a dual role.
Yeah, well, Divine played a man in my other films, too. In Female Trouble, it was a dual role. But in this, he plays, like, I think, kind of a lovable mom. Edna Turnblad. And then he also plays an evil station manager who won't let blacks on the show. And we wanted to make him totally unrecognizable. We had new teeth made for him.
No kidding.
I mean, so that he even talks to, his face is shaped differently and talks differently because all the teeth are fake. So I liked him. I thought he looked like sort of scary almost as a man.
Oh,
it's his male impersonation.
Divine makes such a sympathetic housewife.
Yeah. And I don't think, I think I'm, it's really, so far, I've been very encouraging that both the Variety Review and the Hollywood Reporter Review have talked a lot about Divine and never mentioned that he was a man. It didn't matter anymore that Divine's a man, which I think is good because he's not a transvestite. He doesn't wear those clothes when he's not making a movie. You can't even call him a drag queen. What self-respecting drag queen would allow themselves to look as hideous as he looks in the beginning of Hairspray? So he's basically a character actor.
There are a lot of teenagers in the movie. Were they familiar with your early work? Did you want them
no,
to see
No, I didn't want them to see them. And I discouraged them from seeing them. I actually just talked to two of them who just rented them all this week and saw it, and they liked them. But that's because they got comfortable with us, and they knew everybody. And by the end, I think if they had seen those beginning films in the very beginning before we shot, it might have frightened some of them.
Might have changed their acting performance,
yeah.
too. They might have
yeah.
thought that you wanted something
more hateful or more over the top.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. You wrote the movie as well as
oh, yeah.
directed it and co-produced it. So the actors were saying your lines. How do you feel about actors improvising on your lines?
I generally don't like it because I shoot the exact script and it screws up people's timing if somebody throws in a line and they don't know the next one's coming. If we do any improvisation, we do it in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
When we realize that there's a dead point where somebody has to walk across the room and there's just dead silence. we'll work that out in improv, or when we do it the run through before we do the take. But mostly, I give producers the script that I turn in. I film exactly that.
You shot the movie on location in Baltimore. There was a time in your early film career when you'd have to shoot on the sly and run from the police.
Yeah. We did that once on one shot, because this time we dealt with the city and we dealt with the state and we had permits. We had police closing the streets and everything, which was amazing to me still that you could take over a neighborhood and everybody just says, okay. I mean, the police would wake up people at 5 a.m. and say, you have to move your car. They're making a movie. And people wouldn't give a peep of not wanting to do it, which amazed me. But one day, we had to get a shot, and they told us we couldn't block the street off because it was rush hour. And we just went and did it anyway, and it was really fun, that hit and run. I hadn't done that in so long. It was just one little shot we had to get. We jumped out of the car, we set up real quick, and before anything could happen, we got it and ran. But it was a great feeling.
Okay, John Waters, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
John Waters recorded in 1988. He wrote and directed the original movie, Hairspray, which was adapted into the hit Broadway show and has now been adapted into a movie musical directed by Adam Shankman, who we heard from earlier. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from the soundtrack of the new film.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. In stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the poet Sekou Sundiata. He died this week at age 58. Sundiata was considered one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. We'll listen back to his Fresh Air interviews, including his final one about his near-death experiences and his kidney transplant. Join us for the next Fresh Air.